without any special problems, and I feel settled in. I don't know what it is, but I've always been interested in wigs. Or maybe I should say I've always been attracted to them, the way some guys are attracted to motorcycles. You know, I hadn't really been aware of it before, but when I went out to do that market research and I had a chance to see all those bald men, or what the company called men with a thinning problem, it really struck me what a lot of guys like that there are in the world. Not that I have personal feelings one way or another towards men who are bald or have a thinning problem. I don't especially like them or dislike them. Take you, for example, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Even if your hair were thinner than it is now, and it will be before long, my feelings towards you would absolutely not change in any way. The only strong feeling I have when I see a man with a thinning problem is that sense I think I mentioned to you before of life being worn away. Now that is something I'm really interested in. I once heard that people reach the peak of their growth at a certain age. I forget whether it was 19 or 20 or what, after which the body starts to wear out. If that's the case, then it's just one part of the wearing away of the body for the hair to fall out and grow thinner. There's nothing strange about it at all. It's normal and natural. If there's any problem in all this, it's the fact that some guys go bald young and others never go bald, even when they're old. I know if I were bald, I'd think it was unfair. I mean, it's a part of the body that really sticks out. Even I understand how they feel, and the problem of thinning hair has nothing to do with me. In most cases, the person losing his hair is in no way responsible for whether the volume of hair he loses is greater or less than anybody else's. When I was working part-time, my boss told me that the genes determine 90% of whether a person is going to go bald or not. A man who has inherited a gene for thinning hair from his grandfather and father is going to lose his hair sooner or later, no matter what he does to prevent it. Where there's the will, there's the way, just doesn't apply to baldness. When the time comes for the gene to stand up and say, "All right now, let's get this show on the road." That is, if genes can stand up and say, "Let's get the show on the road," the hair has no choice but to start falling out. It is unfair, don't you think? I know I think it is. So now you know I'm out here in this factory, far away from where you are, working hard every day. And you know about my deep personal interest in the toupee and its manufacture. Next, I'm going to go into somewhat greater detail on my life and work here. Nah, forget it. Bye-bye.
11. Is this shovel a real shovel? What happened in the night, too? After he fell into a deep sleep, the boy had a vivid dream. He knew it was a dream, though, which came as some comfort to him. I know this is a dream, so what happened before was not a dream. It really, really happened. I can tell the difference between the two. In his dream, the boy had gone out to the garden. It was still the middle of the night, and he was alone. He picked up the shovel and started digging out the hole that the tall man had filled in. The man had left the shovel leaning against the trunk of the tree. Freshly filled in, the hole was not that hard to dig, but just picking up the heavy shovel was enough to take the boy's breath away. And he had no shoes on. The soles of his feet were freezing cold. Even so, he went on panting and digging until he had uncovered the cloth bundle that the man had buried. The wind-up bird no longer cried. The man who had climbed the tree never came down. The night was so silent it almost hurt the boy's ears. The man had just disappeared, it seemed. But finally, this is a dream, the boy thought. It was not a dream that the wind-up bird had cried and the man who looked like his father had climbed the tree. Those things had really happened. So there couldn't be any connection between this and that. Strange, though, here he was in a dream, digging out the real hole. So how was he to distinguish between what was a dream and what was not a dream? Was this shovel a real shovel, or was it a dream shovel? The more he thought, the less he understood. And so the boy stopped thinking and put all his energy into digging the hole. Finally, the shovel came up against the cloth bundle. The boy took great care after that to remove the surrounding dirt so as not to damage the cloth bundle. Then he went down on his knees and lifted the bundle from the hole. There was not a cloud in the sky, and there was no one there to block the moist light of the full moon that poured down on the ground. In the dream, he was free of fear. Curiosity was the feeling that dominated him with its power. He opened the bundle to find a human heart inside. He recognized its shape and color from the picture he had seen in his encyclopedia. The heart was still fresh and alive and moving like a newly abandoned infant. True, it was sending no blood out through its severed artery, but it continued to beat with a strong pulse. The boy heard a loud throbbing in his ears, but it was the sound of his own heart. The buried heart and the boy's own heart went on pounding in perfect unison, as if communicating with each other. The boy steadied his breathing and told himself firmly, "You are not afraid of this. This is just a human heart, that's all. Just like in the encyclopedia. Everybody has one of these. I have one." With steady hands, the boy wrapped the beating heart in the cloth again, returned it to the bottom of the hole, and covered it over with earth. He smoothed the earth with his bare foot so that no one could tell a hole had been dug there, and he stood the shovel against the tree as he had found it. The ground at night was like ice. Climbing over the sill of his window, the boy returned to his own warm, friendly room. He brushed the mud from his feet into his waste basket so as not to dirty his sheets, and he started to crawl into bed. But then he realized that someone was already lying there. Someone was sleeping in his bed, under the covers, in his place. Angry now, the boy stripped the covers back. "Hey, you, get out of there! This is my bed!" He wanted to shout at the person. But no sound came out, because the person he found in the bed was himself. He was already in his bed, asleep, breathing peacefully. The boy stood frozen in place, at a loss for words. "If I am already sleeping here, then where should this me sleep?" Now, for the first time, the boy felt afraid, with a fear that seemed as if it would chill him to the marrow. The boy wanted to shout. He wanted to scream as loud as he could to wake up his sleeping self and everyone else in the house, but his voice would not come. He strained with all his might, but he could produce no sound. Nothing at all. So he put his hand on the shoulder of his sleeping self and shook it as hard as he could. But the sleeping boy would not wake up. There was nothing more he could do. The boy stripped off his cardigan and flung it on the floor. Then he pushed his other sleeping self as hard as he could away from the center of the bed and crammed himself into the small space that was left for him at the edge. He had to secure a spot for himself here. Otherwise, he might be pushed out of this world where he belonged. Cramped and without a pillow, the boy nevertheless felt incredibly sleepy as soon as he lay down. He could not think any more. The next moment, he was sound asleep. When he woke up in the morning, the boy was in the middle of the bed, alone. His pillow was under his head, as always. He raised himself slowly and looked around the room. At first glance, the room seemed unchanged. It had the same desk, the same bureau, the same wardrobe, the same floor lamp. The hands of the wall clock pointed to 6:20. But the boy knew something was strange. It might all look the same, but this was not the same place where he had gone to sleep the previous night. The air, the light, the sounds, the smells were all just a little bit different from before. Other people might not notice, but the boy knew. He stripped off the covers and looked at himself. He held his hands up and moved each of his fingers in turn. They moved as they should. And his legs moved. He felt no pain or itching. He slipped out of bed and went to the toilet. When he had finished peeing, he stood at the sink and looked at his face in the mirror. He pulled off his pajama top, stood on a chair, and looked at the reflection of his fair-skinned little body. He found nothing unusual. Yet something was different. He felt as if his self had been put into a new container. He knew that he was still not fully accustomed to this new body of his. There was something about this one, he felt, that just didn't match his original self. A sudden feeling of helplessness overtook him, and he tried to call for his mother, but the word would not emerge from his throat. His vocal cords were unable to stir the air, as if the very word mother had disappeared from the world. Before long, the boy realized that the word was not what had disappeared.
12. M's Secret Cure.
Show business world tainted by occult. From the Blah Blah Monthly, November. These occult cures, which have become a kind of craze among members of the entertainment world, are spread primarily by word of mouth, but in some cases they bear the mark of certain secret organizations. Take, for example, M, 33, started out 10 years ago as supporting actress in a television drama series. Well-received leading roles ever since in TV and films, 6 years ago married Boy Wonder property developer. No problems in first 2 years of marriage. His business did well, and she recorded some fine performances on film. But then the dinner club and boutique he opened in her name ran into trouble, and he started bouncing checks, for which she became liable. Never eager to go into business to begin with, M had more or less had her arm twisted by her husband, who wanted to expand. One view has it that the husband was taken in by a kind of scam. In addition, there had always been a serious rift between M and her in-laws. Soon the gossip spread about the trouble M was having with her husband, and before long, the two were living separately. They concluded formal divorce proceedings 2 years ago after an arbitrator helped them settle their debts. But after that, M started showing signs of depression, and the need for therapy put her into virtual retirement. According to one source at the studio she worked for, M was regularly plagued by serious delusions after the divorce. She ruined her health with antidepressants, and it got to the point where people were saying she's had it as an actress. Our source observed, "She had lost the powers of concentration you need to act, and it was shocking what happened to her looks. It didn't help either that she was basically a serious person who would dwell on things to the point where it would affect her mentally. At least her financial settlement had left her in pretty good shape, so she could make it for a while without working." One distant relative of M's was the wife of a famous politician and former cabinet minister. M was practically a daughter to this person, who introduced her to a woman who practiced a form of spiritual healing for a very limited upper-class clientele. M went to her for a year on a regular basis for treatment of her depression, but exactly what this treatment consisted of, no one knows. M herself kept it absolutely secret. Whatever it was, it seems to have worked. It wasn't long before M was able to stop taking antidepressants, as a result of which she lost the strange puffiness the medicine had caused. Her hair regained its fullness, and her beauty returned. She recovered mentally as well, and gradually began acting again. At that point, she stopped the treatments. In October of this year, however, just as the memory of her nightmare was beginning to fade, M had one episode during which, for no apparent reason, her symptoms flared up again. The timing couldn't have been worse. She had a major acting job just a few days ahead of her, something she could not have carried off in her present state. M contacted the woman and requested the usual treatment, but the woman told her that she was no longer in practice. "I'm sorry," she said, "but I can't do anything for you. I'm not qualified anymore. I've lost my powers. There is someone I can introduce you to, but you'll have to swear absolute secrecy. If you say one word about it to anyone, you'll be sorry. Is that clear?" M was instructed to go to a certain place, where she was brought into the presence of a man with a bluish mark on his face. The man, around 30, never spoke while she was there, but his treatment was incredibly effective. M refused to divulge what she paid for the session, but we can imagine that the consultation fee was quite substantial. This is what we know about the mysterious treatment as told by M to a trusted, very close friend. She first had to go to a certain hotel, where she met a young man whose job it was to guide her to the healer. They left from a special underground VIP parking lot in a big black car and went to the place where the treatment was performed. As far as the treatment itself is concerned, however, we have been able to learn nothing. M is said to have told her friend, "Those people have awesome powers. Something terrible could happen to me if I broke my promise." M paid only one visit to the place, and she has not since suffered any seizures. We tried approaching M directly for more information on the treatment and the mysterious woman, but, as expected, she refused to see us. According to one well-informed source, this organization generally avoids contacts with the entertainment world and concentrates on the more secretive worlds of politics and finance. Our contacts in the performing arts have, so far, yielded no more information.
13. The Waiting Man. What couldn't be shaken off? No man is an island. 8 o'clock came and went, and everything was dark when I opened the back gate and stepped out into the alley. I had to squeeze through sideways, Less than 3 feet high, the gate had been cleverly camouflaged in the corner of the fence so as to be undetectable from the outside. The alley emerged from the night, illuminated as always by the cold white light of the mercury lamp in the garden of May Kasahara's house. I clicked the gate shut and slipped down the alley. Through one fence after another, I caught glimpses of people in their dining rooms and living rooms, eating and watching TV dramas. Food smells drifted into the alley through kitchen windows and extractor fans. One teenage boy was practicing a fast passage on his electric guitar with the volume turned down. In a second-floor window, a tiny girl was studying at her desk, an earnest expression on her face. A married couple having a heated argument sent their voices out into the alley. A baby was screaming. A telephone rang. Reality spilled out into the alley like water from an overfilled bowl, as sound, as smell, as image, as plea, as response. I wore my usual tennis shoes to keep my step silent. My pace could be neither too fast nor too slow. The important thing was not to attract people's attention, not to let that reality pick up on my passing presence. I knew every corner, every obstacle. Even in the dark, I could slip down the alley without bumping into anything. When I reached the back of my house, I stopped, looked around, and climbed over the low wall. The house crouched in the darkness like the shell of a giant animal. I unlocked the kitchen door, turned on the light, and changed the cat's water. I took a tin of cat food from the cupboard and opened it. Mackerel heard the sound and appeared from nowhere. He rubbed his head against my leg a few times, then started to tear into his food. While he was eating, I took a cold beer from the refrigerator. I always had supper in the residence, something that Cinnamon had prepared for me, and so the most I ever had here was a salad or a slice of cheese. Drinking my beer, I took the cat on my knees and confirmed his warmth and softness with my hands. Having spent the day in separate places, we both confirmed the fact that we were home. Tonight, however, when I slipped my shoes off and reached out to turn the kitchen light on, I felt a presence. I stopped in the darkness and listened, inhaling quietly. I heard nothing, but I caught the faint scent of tobacco. There was someone in the house, someone waiting for me to come home, someone who, a few moments earlier, had probably given up the struggle and lit a cigarette, taking no more than a few puffs and opening a window to let the smoke out. But still the smell remained. This could not be a person I knew. The house was still locked up, and I didn't know anyone who smoked, apart from Nutmeg Agasaka, who would hardly be waiting in the dark if she wanted to see me. Instinctively, my hand reached out in the darkness, feeling for the bat. But it was no longer there. It was at the bottom of the well now. The sound my heart had started making was almost unreal, as if the heart itself had escaped from my chest and was beating beside my ear. I tried to keep my breathing regular. I probably didn't need the bat. If someone was here to hurt me, he wouldn't be sitting around inside. Still, my palms were itching with anticipation. My hands were seeking the touch of the bat. Mackerel came from somewhere in the darkness and, as usual, started meowing and rubbing his head against my leg. But he was not as hungry as usual. I could tell from the sounds he made. I reached out and turned on the kitchen light.
"Sorry, but I went ahead and gave the cat his supper," said the man on the living room sofa, with an easy lilt to his voice. "I've been waiting a very long time for you, Mr. Okada, and the cat was all over my feet and meowing, so I hope you don't mind. I found a tin of cat food in the cupboard and gave it to him. To tell you the truth, I'm not very good with cats."
He showed no sign of standing up. I watched him sitting there and said nothing.
"I'm sure this was quite a shock to you, finding somebody in your house waiting for you in the dark. I'm sorry, really, but if I had turned the light on, you might not have come in. I'm not here to do you any harm, believe me, so you don't have to look at me that way. I just need to have a little talk with you."
He was a short man, dressed in a suit. It was hard to guess his height while he was seated, but he couldn't have been 5 feet tall, Somewhere between 45 and 50 years old, he looked like a chubby little frog with a bald head, a definite A in Mei Kasahara's classification system. He did have a few clumps of hair clinging to his scalp over his ears, but their odd black presence made the bare area stand out all the more. He had a large nose, which may have been a bit blocked, judging by the way it expanded and contracted like a bellows with each noisy breath he took. Above that noise sat a pair of thick-looking wire-rimmed glasses. He had a way of pronouncing certain words so that his upper lip would curl, revealing a mouthful of crooked, tobacco-stained teeth. He was, without question, one of the ugliest human beings I had ever encountered, and not just physically ugly. There was a certain clammy weirdness about him that I could not put into words, the sort of feeling you get when your hand brushes against some big, strange insect in the darkness. He looked less like a human being than like something from a long-forgotten nightmare.
"Do you mind if I have a smoke?"
he asked.
"I was trying not to before, but sitting and waiting without a cigarette, it's like torture. It's a very bad habit."
Finding it difficult to speak, I simply nodded. The strange-looking man took an unfiltered piece from his jacket pocket, put it between his lips, and made a loud, dry scratching sound as he lit it with a match. Then he picked up the empty cat food tin at his feet and dropped the match into it. So he had been using the tin as an ashtray. He sucked the smoke into his lungs with obvious pleasure, drawing his thick eyebrows into one shaggy line and letting out little moans. Each long puff made the end of the cigarette glow bright red like burning coal. I opened the patio door and let the outside air in. A light rain was falling. I couldn't see it or hear it, but I knew it was raining from the smell. The man had on a brown suit, white shirt, and red tie, all of the same cheap quality, and all worn out to the same degree. The color of the suit was reminiscent of an amateur paint job on an old car. The deep wrinkles in the trousers and jacket looked as permanent as valleys in an aerial photograph. The white shirt had taken on a yellow tinge, and one button on the chest was ready to fall off. It also looked one or two sizes too small, with its top button open and the collar crooked. The tie, with its strange pattern of ill-formed ectoplasm, looked like a leftover from the days of the Osmond brothers. Anyone looking at him would have seen straight off that this was a man who paid no attention whatsoever to the phenomenon of clothing. He wore what he wore because he had no choice but to put something on when dealing with other people, as if he were hostile to the idea of wearing clothes at all. He might have been planning to wear these things the same way every day until they fell apart, like a Highland farmer driving his donkey from morning to night until he kills it. Once he had sucked all the nicotine he needed into his lungs, he gave a sigh of relief, and a strange look that hovered somewhere between a smile and a smirk appeared on his face. Then he opened his mouth.
"Well, now, let me not forget to introduce myself. I am not usually so rude. The name is Ushikawa. That's Ushi for bull, and Kawa for river. Easy enough to remember, don't you think? Everybody calls me Ushi. Funny, the more I hear that, the more I feel like a real bull. I even feel a kind of affinity whenever I happen to see a bull out in the field somewhere. Names are funny things, don't you think, Mr. Okada? Take Okada, for example. Now there's a nice clean name. Hill Field. I sometimes wish I had a normal name like that, but unfortunately a surname is not something you're free to pick. Once you're born into this world as Ushikawa, you're Ushikawa for life, like it or not. They've been calling me Ushi since the day I started nursery school. There's no way around it. You get a guy named Ushikawa, and people are bound to call him Ushi, right? They say a name expresses the thing it stands for, but I wonder if it isn't the other way around. The thing gets more and more like its name. Anyhow, just think of me as Ushikawa. And if you feel like it, call me Ushi. I don't mind.
I went to the kitchen and brought back a can of beer from the refrigerator. I did not offer any to Ushikawa. I hadn't invited him here after all. I said nothing and drank my beer, and Ushikawa said nothing and drew deeply on his cigarette. I did not sit in the chair across from him, but rather stood, leaning against a pillar, looking down at him. Finally, he stubbed his butt out in the empty cat food tin and looked up at me.
I'm sure you're wondering how I got in here, Mr. Okada. True, you're sure you locked the door, and in fact it was locked. But I have a key, a real key. Look, here it is.
He thrust his hand into his jacket pocket, pulled out a key ring with one key attached, and held it up for me to see. It certainly did look like the key to this house. But what attracted my attention was the key holder. It was just like Kumiko's, a simple-styled green leather key holder with a ring that opened in an unusual way.
"It's the real thing,"
said Ushikawa.
"As you can see, and the holder belongs to your wife. Let me say this to avoid any misunderstanding. This was given to me by your wife, Kumiko. I did not steal it or take it by force."
"Where is Kumiko?" I asked, my voice sounding somewhat mangled. Ushikawa took his glasses off, seemed to check on the cloudiness of the lenses, then put them back on.
"I know exactly where she is,"
he said.
"In fact, I'm taking care of her."
"Taking care of her?"
"Now, don't get me wrong. I don't mean it that way. Don't worry,"
Ushikawa said with a smile. When he smiled, his face broke up asymmetrically from side to side, and his glasses went up at an angle.
"Please don't glare at me like that. I'm just helping her as part of my work, running errands, doing odd jobs. I'm a dog's body, that's all. You know how she can't go outside?"
"Can't go outside?" I parroted his words again. He hesitated a moment, his tongue flicking across his lips.
"Well, maybe you don't know. That's all right. I can't really say whether she can't go out or doesn't want to go out. I'm sure you would like to know, Mr. Okada, but please don't ask me. Not even I know all the details. But there's nothing for you to worry about. She's not being held against her will. I mean, this is not a movie or a novel. We can't really do that sort of thing."
I set my beer can down with care at my feet. "So, anyway, tell me, what did you come here for?" After patting his knees several times with outstretched palms, Ushikawa gave one deep, sharp nod.
"Ah, yes. I forgot to mention that, didn't I? I go to all the trouble of introducing myself, and then I forget to tell you what I'm here for. That has been one of my most consistent flaws over the years, to go on and on about foolish things and leave out the main point. No wonder I'm always doing the wrong thing. Well then, belated though it may be, here it is. I work for your wife Kumiko's elder brother. Ushikawa's the name. But I already told you that, about the Ushi and everything. I work for Dr. Naboru Wataya, as a kind of private secretary, though not the usual private secretary that a member of the Diet might have. Only a certain kind of person, a superior kind of person, can be a real private secretary. The term covers a wide range of types. I mean, there are private secretaries, and then there are private secretaries, and I'm as close to the second kind as you can get. I'm down there. I mean, way, way down there. If there are spirits lurking everywhere, I'm one of the dirty little ones down in the corner of a bathroom or a cupboard. But I can't complain. If somebody this messy came right out in the open, think of what it could do to Dr. Wataya's clean-cut image. No, the ones who face the cameras have to be slick, intelligent-looking types. not bald midgets. Howdy-do, folks, it's me, Dr. Watayev's private secretary. What a laugh. Right, Mr. Okada?
I kept silent as he prattled on.
So, what I do for the doctor are the unseen jobs, the shadow jobs, so to speak, the ones that aren't out in the open. I'm the fiddler under the porch. Jobs like that are my specialty. Like this business with Miss Kumiko. Now, don't get me wrong. Don't think that taking care of her is just some busy work for a lowly hack. If what I've said has given you that impression, it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, Miss Kumiko is the doctor's one and only dear little sister, after all. I consider it a consummate honor to have been allowed to take on such an important task, believe me. Oh, by the way, this may seem very rude, but I wonder if I could ask you for a beer. All this talking has made me very thirsty. If you don't mind, I'll just grab one myself. I know where it is. While I was waiting, I took the liberty of peeking into the refrigerator.
I nodded to him. Ushikawa went to the kitchen and took a bottle of beer from the refrigerator. Then he sat down on the sofa again, drinking straight from the bottle with obvious relish, his huge Adam's apple twitching above the knot of his tie like some kind of animal.
Oh, I tell you, Mr. Okada, a cold beer at the end of the day is the best thing life has to offer. Some choosy people say that a too cold beer doesn't taste good, but I couldn't disagree more. The first beer should be so cold you can't even taste it. The second one should be a little less chilled, but I want that first one to be like ice. I want it to be so cold my temples throb with pain. This is my own personal preference, of course.
Still leaning against the pillar, I took another sip of my own beer. Lips closed tight in a straight line, Ushikawa surveyed the room for some moments.
I must say, Mr. Okada, for a man without a wife, you do keep the house clean. I'm very impressed. I myself am completely hopeless, I'm embarrassed to say. My place is a mess, a garbage heap, a pigsty. I haven't washed the bathtub for a year or more. Perhaps I neglected to tell you that I was also deserted by my wife 5 years ago, so I can feel a certain sympathy for you, Mr. Okada. Or to avoid the risk of misinterpretation, let me just say that I can understand how you feel. Of course, my situation was different from yours. It was only natural for my wife to leave me. I was the worst husband in the world. Far from complaining, I have to admire her for having put up with me as long as she did. I used to beat her. No one else. She was the only one I could beat up. You can tell what a weakling I am. Got the heart of a flea. I would do nothing but grovel outside the house. People would call me Ushi and order me around, and I would just suck up to them all the more. So, when I got home, I would take it out on my wife. Pretty bad, eh? And I knew just how bad I was, but I couldn't stop. It was like a sickness. I'd beat her face out of shape until you couldn't recognize her. And not just beat her. I'd slam her against the wall and kick her, pour hot tea on her, throw things at her, you name it. The kids would try to stop me, and I'd end up hitting them. Little kids, 7, 8 years old, and not just push them around. I'd wallop them with everything I had. I was an absolute devil. I'd try to stop myself, but I couldn't. I couldn't control myself. After a certain point, I would tell myself that I had done enough damage, that I had to stop. But I didn't know how to stop. Do you see what a horror I was? So then, 5 years ago, when my daughter was 5, I broke her arm. Just snapped it. That's when my wife finally got fed up with me and left with both kids. I haven't seen any of them since. Haven't even heard from them. But what can I do? It's my own fault.
I said nothing to him. The cat came over to me and gave a short meow, as if looking for attention.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I wasn't planning to exhaust you with all these boring details. You must be wondering if I have any business that has brought me here this evening. Well, I have. I didn't come here for small talk, Mr. Okada. The doctor, which is to say Dr. Wataya, ordered me to come to see you. I will now tell you exactly what he told me. So please, listen. First of all, Dr. Wataya is not opposed to the idea of reconsidering your relationship between you and Ms. Kumiko. In other words, he would not object if both of you decided that you wanted to go back to your previous relationship. At the moment, Miss Kumiko herself has no such intention, so nothing would happen right away. But if you were to reject any possibility of divorce and insist that you wanted to wait as long as it took, he could accept that. He will no longer insist upon a divorce as he has in the past, and so he would not mind if you wanted to use me as a conduit, if there was something you wished to communicate to Ms. Kumiko. In other words, no more locking horns on every little thing, a renewal of diplomatic relations, as it were. This is the first item of business. How does it strike you, Mr. Okada?
I lowered myself to the floor and stroked the cat's head, but I said nothing. Ushikawa watched me and the cat for a time, then continued to speak.
Well, of course, Mr. Okada, you can't say a word until you've heard everything I have to say. All right, then, I will continue through to the end. Here is the second item of business. This gets a little complicated, I'm afraid. It has to do with an article called The Hanging House, which appeared in one of the weekly magazines. I don't know if you've read it or not, Mr. Okada, but it is a very interesting piece. Well written. Jinxed land in posh Setagaya residential neighborhood. Many people met untimely deaths there over the years. What mystery man has recently bought the place? What is going on behind that high fence? One riddle after another. Anyhow, Dr. Wataya read the piece and realized that the hanging house is very close to the house you live in, Mr. Okada. The idea began to gnaw at him that there might be some connection between it and you. So he investigated, or should I say, the lowly Ushikawa, on his short little legs, took the liberty of investigating the matter. And bingo, there you were, Mr. Okada, just as he had predicted, going back and forth down that back passageway every day to the other house, obviously very much involved with whatever it is that is going on inside there. I myself was truly amazed to see such a powerful display of Dr. Wataya's penetrating intelligence. There has only been one article so far with no follow-up, but who knows? Dying embers can always rekindle. I mean, that's a pretty fascinating story. So Dr. Wataya is more than a little nervous. What if his brother-in-law's name were to come out in some unpleasant connection? Think of the scandal that could erupt. Dr. Wataya is the man of the moment, after all. The media would have a field day. And then there's this difficult business with you and Ms. Kumiko. They would blow it up out of all proportion. I mean, everybody has something he would rather not have aired in public, right? Especially when it comes to personal affairs. This is a delicate moment in the doctor's political career, after all. He has to proceed with the utmost caution until he's ready to take off. So what he has in mind for you is a little deal of sorts he's cooked up. If you will cut all connection with this hanging house, Mr. Okada, he will give some serious thought to bringing you and Miss Kumiko back together again. That's all there is to it. How does that strike you, Mr. Okada? Have I said it out with sufficient clarity?
Probably, I said.
So what do you think? What is your reaction to all this?
Stroking the cat's neck, I thought about it for a while. Then I said, I don't get it. What made Noboru Wataya think that I had anything to do with that house? How did he make the connection? Ushikawa's face broke into one of his big smiles, but his eyes remained as cold as glass. He took a crushed pack of cigarettes from his pocket and lit up with a match.
Ah, Mr. Okada, you ask such difficult questions. Remember, I'm just a lowly messenger, a stupid carrier pigeon. I carry slips of paper back and forth. I think you understand. I can't say this, however. The doctor is no fool. He knows how to use his brain, and he has a kind of sixth sense, something that ordinary people do not possess. And also let me tell you this, Mr. Okada. He has a very real kind of power that he can exercise in this world, a power that grows stronger every day. You had better not ignore it. You may have your reasons for not liking him, and that is fine as far as I am concerned. It's none of my business. But things have gone beyond the level of simple likes and dislikes. I want you to understand that.
If Noboru Wataya is so powerful, why doesn't he just stop the magazine from publishing any more articles? That would be a whole lot simpler.
Ushikawa smiled. Then he inhaled deeply on his cigarette.
Dear, dear Mr. Okada, you mustn't say such reckless things. You and I live in Japan, after all, one of the world's most truly democratic states. Correct? This is no dictatorship where all you see around you are banana plantations and soccer fields. No matter how much power a politician may have in this country, quashing an article in a magazine is not a simple thing. It would be far too dangerous. You might succeed in getting the company top brass in your pocket, but someone is going to be left dissatisfied, and that could end up attracting all the more attention. It just doesn't pay to try pushing people around when such a hot story is involved, believe me. And just between you and me, there may be some vicious players interested in this affair. Types you don't know anything about, Mr. Okada. If that's the case, this is eventually going to involve more than our dear doctor. Once that happens, we could be talking about a whole new ballgame. Let's compare this to a visit to the dentist. So far, we're at the stage of poking a spot where the Novocaine's still working, which is why no one's complaining. But soon the drill is going to hit a nerve, and then somebody's going to jump out of the chair. Somebody could get seriously angry. Do you see what I'm saying? I'm not trying to threaten you, but it seems to me, to old Ushikawa here, that you are, little by little, being dragged into dangerous territory without even realizing it.
Ushikawa seemed at last to have made his point.
You mean I should pull out before I get hurt? I asked.
Ushikawa nodded.
This is like playing catch in the middle of the expressway, Mr. Okada. It's a very dangerous game.
In addition to which, it's going to cause Noboru Wataya a lot of trouble. So if I just throw in my hand, he'll put me in touch with Kumiko. Ushikawa nodded again.
That about sums it up.
I took a swallow of beer. Then I said,
First of all, let me tell you this. I'm going to get Kumiko back, but I'm going to do it myself without help from Noboru Wataya. I don't want his help. And you're right about one thing. I don't like Noboru Wataya. As you say, though, this is not just a question of likes and dislikes. It's something more basic than that. I don't simply dislike him. I cannot accept the fact of his very existence. And so I refuse to make any deals with him. Please be so kind as to convey that to him for me. And don't you ever come into this house again without my permission. It is my house, not some hotel lobby or train station.
Ushikawa narrowed his eyes and stared at me from behind his glasses. His eyes remained motionless. As before, they were devoid of emotion. Not that they were expressionless. But all that was there was something fabricated temporarily for the occasion. At that point, he held his disproportionately large right palm aloft, as if checking for rain.
I understand completely,
he said.
I never thought this would be easy, so I'm not surprised by your answer. Besides, I don't surprise very easily. I understand how you feel, and I'm glad everything is out in the open like this. No hemming and hawing, just a simple yes or no. Makes it easier for everybody. The last thing I need as a carrier pigeon is another convoluted answer where you can't tell black from white. The world has too many of those as it is. Not that I'm complaining, but all I seem to get every day are sphinxes giving me riddles. This job is bad for my health, let me tell you. Living like this, before you know it, you become devious by nature. Do you see what I mean, Mr. Okada? You become suspicious, always looking for ulterior motives, never able to put your faith in anything that's clear and simple. It's a terrible thing, Mr. Okada, it really is. So, fine, Mr. Okada, I will let the doctor know that you have given him a very clear-cut answer. But don't expect things to end there. You may want to finish this business, but it's not that simple. I will probably have to come to see you again. I'm sorry to put you through this, having to deal with such an ugly, messy little fellow, but please try to accustom yourself to my existence at least. I don't harbor any ill feelings towards you as an individual, Mr. Okada, really, but for the time being, whether you like it or not, I'm going to be one of those things that you can't just sweep away. I know it's an odd way to put it, but please try to think of me like that. I can promise you one thing, though. I will not be letting myself into your house again. You are quite right. That is not a proper way to behave. I should go down on my knees and beg to be let in. This time, I had no choice. Please try to understand. I am not always so reckless. Appearances to the contrary, I am an ordinary human being. From now on, I will do as other people do and call beforehand. That should be all right, don't you think? I will ring once, hang up, then ring again. You'll know it's me that way, and you can tell yourself, oh, it's that stupid Ushikawa again, when you pick up the phone. But do pick up the phone. Otherwise, I will have no choice but to let myself in again. Personally, I would rather not do such a thing, but I am being paid to wag my tail. So when my boss says, do it, I have to try my best to do it. You understand.
I said nothing to him. Ushikawa crushed what was left of his cigarette in the bottom of the cat food tin, then glanced at his watch as if suddenly remembering something.
Oh, my. Look how late it is. First I come barging in, then I talk you to death and take your beer. Please excuse me. As I said earlier, I don't have anybody to go home to. So when I find someone I can talk to, I settle in for the night. Sad, don't you think? I tell you, Mr. Okada, living alone is not something you should do for long. What is it they say? No man is an island? Or is it the devil finds mischief for idle hands?
After sweeping some imaginary dust from his lap, Ushikawa stood up slowly.
No need to see me out,
he said.
I let myself in after all. I can let myself out. I'll be sure to lock the door. One last word of advice, though, Mr. Okada, though you may not want to hear this. There are things in this world it is better not to know about. Of course, those are the very things that people most want to know about. It's strange. I know I'm being very general. I wonder when we'll meet again. I hope things are better by then. Oh, well, good night.
The quiet rain continued through the night, tapering off towards dawn. But the sticky presence of the strange little man and the smell of his unfiltered cigarettes remained in the house as long as the lingering dampness. 14. Cinnamon's Strange Sign Language. The Musical Offering.
Cinnamon stopped talking once and for all just before his 6th birthday,
Nutmeg said to me.
It was the year he should have entered junior school. All of a sudden that February he stopped talking, and, strange as it may seem, it was night before we noticed that he hadn't said a word all day. True, he was never much of a talker, but still, when it finally occurred to me what was happening, I did everything I could to make him speak. I talked to him, I shook him, nothing worked. He was like a stone. I didn't know whether he had suddenly lost the power to speak or he had decided on his own that he would stop speaking, and I still don't know. But he's never said another word, never made another sound. He'll never scream if he's in pain, and you can tickle him, but he'll never laugh out loud.
Nutmeg took her son to several different ear, nose, and throat specialists, but none of them could locate the cause. All they could determine was that it was not physical. Cinnamon could hear perfectly well, but he wouldn't speak. All the doctors concluded that it must be psychological in origin. Nutmeg took him to a psychiatrist friend of hers, but he also was unable to establish a cause for Cinnamon's continued silence. He administered an IQ test, but there was no problem there. In fact, Cinnamon turned out to have an unusually high IQ. The doctor could find no evidence of emotional problems either.
"Has he experienced some kind of shock?"
the psychiatrist asked Nutmeg.
"Try to think. Could he have witnessed something abnormal or been subjected to violence at home?"
But Nutmeg could think of nothing. One day her son had been normal in every way. He had eaten his meals in the normal way, had normal conversations with her, gone to bed when he was supposed to, had no trouble falling asleep, and the next morning he had sunk into a world of deep silence. There had been no problems at home. The child was being brought up under the ever-watchful gaze of Nutmeg and her mother, neither of whom had ever raised a hand to him. The doctor concluded that the only thing they could do was observe him and hope that something would turn up. Unless they knew the cause, there was no way of treating him. Nutmeg should take Cinnamon to see the doctor once a week, in the course of which they might figure out what had happened. It was possible that he would just start speaking again, like someone waking from a dream. All they could do was wait. True, the child was not speaking, but there was nothing else wrong with him. And so they waited. But Cinnamon never again rose to the surface of his deep ocean of silence. Its electric motor producing a low hum, the front gate began to swing inwards at 9 o'clock in the morning, and Cinnamon's Mercedes-Benz 500 SEL pulled into the driveway. The car phone's aerial protruded from the back window like a newly sprouted tentacle. I watched through a crack in the blinds. The car looked like some kind of huge migratory fish, afraid of nothing. The brand-new black tires traced a silent arc over the concrete surface and came to a stop in the designated spot. They traced exactly the same arc every morning and stopped in exactly the same place with probably no more than 2 inches variation. I was drinking the coffee that I had brewed for myself a few minutes earlier. The rain had stopped, but gray clouds covered the sky, and the ground was still black and cold and wet. The birds raised sharp cries as they flitted back and forth in search of worms on the ground. The driver's door opened after a short pause, and Cinnamon stepped out, wearing sunglasses. After a quick scan of the area, he took the glasses off and slipped them into his breast pocket. Then he closed the car door. The precise sound of the big Mercedes door latch was different from the sounds other car doors made. For me, this sound marked the beginning of another day at the residence. I had been thinking all morning about Ushikawa's visit the night before, wondering whether I should tell Cinnamon that Ushikawa had been sent by Noboru Wataya to get me to pull out of the activities conducted at this house. In the end, though, I decided not to tell him, for the time being at least. This was something that had to be settled between Noboru Wataya and me. I didn't want to have any third parties involved. Cinnamon was stylishly dressed, as always, in a suit. All his suits were of the finest quality, tailored to fit him like a glove. They tended to be rather conservative in cut, but on him they looked youthful, as if transformed by magic into the latest fashion. He wore a new tie, of course, one to match that day's suit. His shirt and shoes were different as well. His mother, Nutmeg, had picked everything out for him in her usual way. His outfit was as spotless top to bottom as the Mercedes he drove. Each time he showed up in the morning, I found myself admiring him, or I might even say moved by him. What kind of being could possibly lie hidden beneath that perfect exterior? Cinnamon took 2 paper shopping bags full of food and other necessaries out of the trunk and held them in his arms as he entered the residence. Embraced by him, even these ordinary paper bags from the supermarket looked elegant and artistic. Maybe he had some special way of holding them, or possibly it was something more basic than that. His whole face lit up when he saw me. It was a marvelous smile, as if he had just emerged into a bright opening after a long walk in a deep wood. "Good morning," I said to him. "Good morning," he did not say to me, though his lips moved. He proceeded to take the groceries out of the bags and arrange them in the refrigerator like a bright child committing newly acquired knowledge to memory. The other supplies he arranged in the cupboards. Then he had a cup of coffee with me. We sat across from each other at the kitchen table, just as Kumiko and I had done every morning long before.
"Cinema never spent a day at school," said Nutmeg. "Ordinary schools wouldn't accept a child who didn't speak, and I felt it would be wrong to send him to a school with nothing but handicapped children. The reason for his being unable to speak, whatever it was, I knew to be different from other children's reasons. And besides, he never showed any sign of wanting to go to school. He seemed to like best staying at home on his own, reading or listening to classical music or playing in the yard with the dog we had then. He would go out for walks, too, sometimes, but not with much enthusiasm, because he didn't like to be with children his own age."
Nutmeg studied sign language and used that to talk with Cinnamon. When sign language was not enough, they would converse in writing. One day, though, she realized that she and her son were able to convey their feelings to each other perfectly well without resorting to such indirect methods. She knew exactly what he was thinking or requesting, with only the slightest gesture or change of expression. From that point on, she ceased to be concerned about Cinnamon's inability to speak. It certainly wasn't obstructing any mental exchange between mother and son. The absence of spoken language did, of course, give her an occasional sense of physical inconvenience, but it never went beyond the level of inconvenience, and, in a sense, it was this very factor that purified the quality of the communication between the two. During lulls between jobs, Nutmeg would teach Cinnamon how to read and write and do arithmetic, but beyond that there was not that much that she was required to teach him. He liked books, and he would use them to teach himself what he needed to know. She was less a teacher for him than the one who chose the books. He liked music and wanted to play the piano, but after learning the basic finger movements in a few months with a professional piano teacher, he used only manuals and recorded tapes to bring himself to a high level of technical accomplishment for one so young. He loved to play Bach and Mozart, and apart from Poulenc and Bartók, he showed little inclination to play anything beyond the Romantics. During his first 6 years of study, his interests were concentrated on music and reading, but from the time he reached middle school age, he turned to the acquisition of languages, beginning with English and then French. In both cases, he taught himself enough to read simple books after 6 months of study. He had no intention of learning to converse in either language, of course. He wanted only to be able to read books. Another activity he loved was tinkering with complicated machinery. He bought a complete collection of professional tools, with which he was able to build radios and valve amplifiers, and he enjoyed taking clocks apart and fixing them. Everyone around him, which is to say his mother, his father, and his grandmother, Nutmeg's mother, became accustomed to the fact that he never spoke, and ceased to think of it as unnatural or abnormal. After a few years, Nutmeg stopped taking her son to the psychiatrist. The weekly consultations were doing nothing for his symptoms, and as the doctors had noted in the beginning, apart from his not speaking, there was nothing wrong with him. Indeed, he was an almost perfect child. Nutmeg could not recall ever having had to force him to do anything, or to scold him for doing anything he shouldn't have done. He would decide for himself what he had to do, and then he would do it, flawlessly, in his own way. He was so different from other children, ordinary children, that comparing him with them was meaningless. He was 12 when his grandmother died, an event that caused him to go on crying soundlessly for several days, after which he took it upon himself to do the cooking, laundry, and cleaning while his mother was at work. Nutmeg wanted to hire a housekeeper when her mother died, but Cinnamon would not hear of it. He refused to have a stranger come in and disrupt the order of the household. It was Cinnamon, then, who ran the house. and he did so with a high degree of precision and discipline. Cinnamon spoke to me with his hands. He had inherited his mother's slender, well-shaped fingers. They were long, but not too long. He held them up near his face and moved them without hesitation, and like a species of sensible living creature, they communicated his messages to me. "A client will be coming at 2 o'clock,"